Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who will never, ever touch another drop of Carabao ever again, Nathan Lee Clark. Hello, Nathan.
It's literally poisonous.
Yeah, I've heard it's not great. Bardi, or should that be Barn-D?
Very good.
Barn-D. Greg Peth says, Bardi, how's your house?
It's amazing to have so much space. It's not a big house, but it's a massive upgrade from a flat. And it was great to finally get in. It's been 6 months of pain of living with my dad and living in other people's houses and having stuff scattered across London. So it's great to have stuff scattered in a couple of rooms now. I'm still trying to find things. I'm still discovering things which I'd forgotten I had. And then then just trying to organize stuff and dealing with cobwebs, man. I've never seen... Someone should have told me on Rightmove that barns and beams attract spiders. There is spiders everywhere. You'd be in pieces, Windy, because you're scared of spiders, aren't you?
I don't get on well with spiders.
Yeah.
That is true to say.
You wouldn't survive out in these ends, mate.
You're right, I wouldn't. Jam Scone says, built on top of a brand new hill, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I'm thinking about building a hill and just building it right on top of Tottenham and just smothering the lot of them. I'm not in a good mood. No, I mean, Tottenham are on the naughty step and they're going to stay there. And they're lucky I'm so modern that it's a naughty step. Otherwise, you know, when I was young, I would have been stood in the corner, facing the corner like something out of Blair Witch. I'm not happy with them.
I know you're in a bad mood because someone posted earlier in the Fighting Cock WhatsApp group that Nagelsmann's going to Bayern and your response was good.
We don't deserve nice things. You get these players that have a nice manager with a good philosophy. No, no, no. Let's get someone in worse than Mourinho that runs them into the ground.
Worse than Mourinho?
Well, I don't. At least Mourinho give me some joy by burning them to the ground. And I'd like to burn all of them. Anyway, we'll get into it.
Let's talk about the Carabao Cup final. Sigh, all that build up, all that expression of joy that we all had waking up in the morning of the cup final, the sun's out, people are going to Wembley, going to go and have a few beers with their mates. It felt kind of normal again. I felt really pleased to see people on my Twitter timeline who were posting pictures of themselves walking up Wembley Way, and I was just feeling really jealous of them being there. Another team lineups came out. Yeah, so on Twitter, I said that I didn't love the lineup. Privately, I said that the lineup completely bummed me out. I didn't want to bum everyone else out on Twitter, but I did not like that lineup one bit.
They were already bummed out. They were also independently bummed out by seeing the lineups themselves.
Right, right. And it seemed to be mainly directed at Harry Winks, Nathan.
Yeah, and I don't blame people for feeling that way. I feel similarly, you know? That's just where we are now. I tried to sort of rationalise it to myself and be like, okay, it's about sort of containment in the first half, and then at halftime maybe we'll bring Ndombele on, and maybe we'll bring Bale or maybe Dele on, and then we'll have a go of it in the second half. And I think in a lot of ways, that's kind of how the game was starting to play out for us, but then we didn't make those subs, which then does really open up the starting 11 for its full criticism, and I do think that that's fair.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Ndombele was just such a big miss, such an important player in any style we attempt to play, I think, but particularly in this style. I mean, it seems that the one guy you want is the press-resistant midfielder who can actually hold onto the ball in the few moments you can attempt to have possession against a team as aggressively possession-oriented as Man City. Bardi, Kane was involved. So Minneapolis Spur says, when you saw the lineups, did you really think we had a chance today? It's hard to win when you're a man down. Were you concerned about Kane's fitness beforehand? And how did you feel about that at the end of the match?
No, I think Kane playing was the correct decision. Even though perhaps he wasn't as mobile as he should have been, I still thought his link play was pretty good. He remained a constant threat. He was good on the ball. He tried to spring a few decent counter-attacks. I don't think this is Kane's fault, and I can totally understand why Mason felt like playing him. In the same way, I wasn't down about Winks playing either. I thought Winks did okay enough against Southampton, and I could see the logic of kind of playing him. And like Nathan said, you know, survive the first 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and then let's get to half-time and see what's going to happen. We know what Man City are going to do, and the way they monopolise possession, and just kind of hang in there. And then you could see at the start of the second half how the game opened up a little bit. But yeah, that's the time when we should have seen Ndombele. But I wasn't too down about the starting lineup. I was more down about the substitutions and just some of the performances of some of the individuals out there.
I completely agree that the substitutions were a major issue. I agree as well that, like, whilst it's not fun to watch us play like that against Man City, and we got away with a lot, like, as in expected goals for Manchester City was something like 3.5, and for Spurs it was 0.04. This was not a good containment job. We got lucky that City didn't exploit us more. But having got to 80 minutes with this lineup, and having sort of, you could almost see the argument for why they tried to do what they tried to do at 80 minutes. You were like, okay, fine. They've taken a calculated gamble. Not my cup of tea, but it's working to an extent at this point. Let's go and do something. And then we go and concede a goal in the most foolish of ways. And it's really just, it's irritating to concede a set piece goal against Man City. Like they haven't got enough other ways of scoring goals.
I mean, like, I think it's the
most basic mistake.
I think a lot of people have been a little bit unfair here, you know, because, you know, a set piece goal does involve skill, and De Bruyne whips that in with skill, and Laporte attacks it. And it's, you know, we've talked a lot about set piece goals being able to split tight games. So I think it's not like a Burnley set piece goal, but even that's been unfair. I think the goal is fair and it counts. It counts as a goal. So I think to lose to a set piece goal is like a sentence which doesn't make too sense. They make much sense because they forced us into an error and then they exploited it with a great cross. I think it was the build up to that. And it was just Aurier. And you can't blame Aurier because he gives away the free kick. But it's just this continual bullshit from a lot of our players. I've seen Aurier do that 1,000 times. And he keeps doing that. And it's that which bothered me. It's the continued mistake from the same individuals. And they keep getting game time. Perhaps I would... We all forgive Mason for this. And that's fair because he's a young guy and it's not his team. It's not his fault.
There's nothing to forgive. It's, you know, it's his second game in management. I don't think there's anything to forgive.
I just think had he just played Tanganga, had he just played Ndombele, had he not put Sissoko in, had he not put Aurier in, then there could have been, we could have taken something from this. But it's just, that was a Jose Mourinho team and a Jose Mourinho performance. And I was expecting a bit more from Mason, and I was expecting a little bit more from our players. And I don't blame Mason. I put this squarely on our players. And I think it's unfair. I think Son has got a lot of criticism. I turned the TV off, but I heard about him crying. And I was just like, a little bit like, this is going to sound proper coy's gammon football, but I'm just a bit like, fuck off, mate. I'm just at that point with Tottenham where I'm just like, you could have done better. And I understand you're upset, but you're nowhere near as upset as me.
Yeah, I wondered whether Son in part was crying at his own performance and like out of a sense of frustration because he was really bad. Really bad. On the Aurier point, so this is where when people talk about mentality and having a winning mentality and the right attitude. So this is what mentality is to me. It's Aurier's mistake there. So I don't think that we set out to aggressively press Man City. So to say that we weren't trying, I think is completely unfair because I thought the players stuck to their target. They didn't do, you know, tactically it was poor. I don't think the players didn't try. I thought they tried. But Aurier just has these lapses. And it's really frustrating because, as you mentioned, they happen time and time and time again. And he had a really good game on the whole. I thought Aurier played well. He was effective. He made some good challenges. He was sensible. And then he does the most Serge Aurier thing, like a completely unnecessary challenge. And that, for me, is the sort of the mentality issue that if anything, you need to fix. It's players making mistakes that we've seen them make a million times before and not being able to correct them. That's like as serious as people's assertions that they're not trying hard enough, to not running fast enough, not aggressive enough. Like that is my issue with mentality, and I don't think you can fix it with a player like Aurier. Otherwise, someone would have done by now. And I think it's certainly time that he leaves, which is a damn shame because he's got a lot of positive attributes, but you can't trust him. You just can't trust him. Nathan, what did you think Mason was trying to do with his substitutes?
I'm really not sure, other than just sort of keep legs fresh, to be honest. I mean, there's an extent to which like Bale is the obvious pick as like a player with sort of limited energy, limited defensive contribution, but is going to be pretty wicked on the counter attack and saving that for late. That for me makes perfect sense. I thought on the day Lucas was having a much better game than Son,
and so maybe for sure.
But whatever. The lack of Ndombele is really frustrating. At no point during this process have I thought, yeah, right, Mason should be our long-term manager, you know, slap down a contract for 5 years and let him write whatever number he wants, all that kind of nonsense. But I did, I think, get a little carried away with this imagination of Ryan Mason, who was going to make the kind of decisions that I want to be made, right? Talking about Tottenham playing attacking football, talking about Pochettino influence, talking about pride in a club and all those kind of things. And I sort of fallen in love with Ryan Mason a little bit. And I'm thinking, yeah, he's gonna start in Ndombele. He's going to start Tanganga. And then it's just not materialising in any of those kind of ways in that game. And so I am disappointed. I am frustrated. That game was crying out for Ndombele. Because when we did beat City late last year, Ndombele's ability to find Kane was absolutely enormous, and that's always going to be the case. As you were saying earlier, we don't really need to re-treasure. But I mean, Wink starting, I can kind of forgive it. I can kind of say, okay, you want Højbjerg to play one of the wide central midfielders. You need someone to sit in there and be the number six. I get that, and okay, yeah. But again, like I said earlier, all of that is based on the premise that you're then going to make that switch later on, and that switch just doesn't come, and then you have to say, well, why are you playing Winks 2021? Why are you bringing Sissoko on to play alongside him 2021? We are now, what, 3.5 years into seeing Winks and Sissoko in midfield together, and it's just so exhausting that this is still where we are at as a club. Three managers saying, yeah, these are my guys, these are who I want to be seeing on the pitch together, and it's never works for any of them. Obviously, a lot of that is a reflection of the squad building going on at the club long term, but there's still at least two of those managers who'd never had to play either of these two players if they didn't want to, and yet we're still seeing on the same pitch trying to get a goal. I think if it's Ndombele instead of Sissoko, yes, absolutely, we were lucky to survive the first half, but you're always going to have to be lucky against City. That was always going to have to be essentially part of the game plan. I think if it's Ndombele, if he comes on at half time, not 60 odd minutes, comes on for Lo Celso or maybe Winks or whatever, because the game was slowing down in that second half, it slowed down a lot. I think a lot of the shots, a lot of the XG that City put up would have been from the first half. We started to get off some vaguely threatening counters. Harry Kane couldn't reach a full sprint, although he was still sort of almost useful player on the break. Son looked like, I don't know, not mentally there. Like a pressure had got to him or something. His passing was terrible. He wasn't making the right runs. Lucas was Lucas, you know, good at what he does. Whether we're better for it is hard to say, you know. But winning fouls, if nothing else, are carrying the ball some distance. And I just thought if Ndombele is in that mix, threading some passes, you know, getting Son to make those runs because of his ability, it could have been a very different second half. So, I mean, it's always, and I was always going to be reluctant to sort of make big, bold claims about Ryan Mason two games in. But I'm definitely frustrated by the decisions he made in this match. That doesn't mean that I'm expecting him to be, lose all the remaining league games. I still think that he can make better decisions going forward from here on. And maybe it'll come out that Ndombele had a knock or an illness or whatever, and all of this conversation is very silly in retrospect. But I was really frustrated by his decisions. And it's not like if we'd have played Ndombele, we'd definitely have won. It's just like we would have had our best chance. And that's all I wanted to see, really, was us to have a go at it. And I didn't think we really had a go at it in the final, which is immensely disappointing.
I mean, I think there is something here we need to look at in depth at some point with Ndombele. Why is this the third manager at Tottenham to not really trust him or start him? Why is another manager having doubts about him? I'm not sure about this.
I don't think that's true. I think Pochettino started him whenever he was match fit. He just had a lot of injuries under Pochettino. Mourinho obviously took his time but was keen to get him in. I hear what you're saying, but I think we need to pause on that a little while long before we start thinking about that.
I think Bardi might be onto something. I think he's misunderstood, honestly. I think he's misunderstood as a player. And I think yesterday showed why he's essential. You know, as Nathan points out, having him in the team doesn't mean we've got a God-given right to suddenly win the game. Like, I still think we lose.
Probably.
But we probably have a go, a bit more of a go. And we maybe accumulate more than 0.04 XG. Just 0.04 XG in a game. I mean, I've been quite, like, gentle with my takes post-match because I'm like, it's Mason's second game in charge against one of the best teams in the world. What do we expect? But that is pitiful, isn't it? 0.04, two shots, is pitiful.
But then why appoint Mason? Like, maybe, I've never thought these words would come out of my mouth, but why don't you just appoint Eddie Howe on a short-term contract? Why don't you give it to somebody with a little bit more experience than Ryan Mason? Is it because we're more willing to forgive because it's Ryan Mason? Or that's what I don't understand about this. Fine, we sacked Mourinho because it was going nowhere and things were getting from bad to worse. Mason's come in, we beat Southampton, and then maybe he could inspire something here, but he's been unable to do that. So why didn't we go for a more experienced stopgap instead of a child in management terms? That's the confusing thing here.
It could be due to cost, or it could just be due to speed. Just, you know, being able to quickly arrange someone to come in and literally take training on those first couple of days. I don't know. Some expertise would have been useful. I mean, Chris Powell is an experienced coach who knows his stuff, you know, which also makes me question why Chris Powell isn't our head coach, but that's a question for another day, potentially. Tricky one to answer. We just need to get through these last, six games, and get a new manager in as soon as possible and feel like we're moving forward. Like Nathan says, I feel like Mason can probably do a fine job in the last few games. I certainly feel more optimistic going into them than I did with Mourinho in charge. And I'd like to think we might see some Dele. We might see a lot more Bale. So that would be fun. But this is a short-term get the season out thing only. It has to be.
I think we can still get top four, and I'm still very glad that we made the call when we did with Mourinho, and that I was able to care about that final because, okay, I'm disappointed. That disappointment is based on there being like hope and even like the desire to win the game going into it and everything. So, I still think taking a step back from this game, things are just so much better. There's been rumours going around and a seemingly leaked Jamie Redknapp voice note that we sacked him after the Everton game because we dropped to seventh and that dramatically lowered how much we had to pay him, which makes a lot of sense of the timing. There you go. I think better times are probably around the corner for us.
I think we need to touch on the refereeing just because several people asked us about it.
Sure.
Cronescast says, is no one else really pissed off with the lack of second yellows in the game? What really annoys me is that City's whole defensive game is built around tactical fouling to stop breaks against them. Fernandinho has been doing it so well for years, we even use that a lot under Poch. It's a vital part of defending when pushing high up the pitch and pressing high. However, the whole point is that there is the risk of getting a second yellow, and therefore they have to be clever in rotating who is making the fouls. Referees are always very reluctant to give a second yellow, especially in big games, and therefore it takes all the risks out of that strategy. Why is this not picked up on more? It was a problem. I mean, the logical argument is that, of course, Laporte wouldn't make that second challenge if he was already on a yellow card. Fine. But why wasn't he already on a yellow card? Why was the ref... I think it's fine with challenges of a sort of 50-50 nature that you might want to think about giving a yellow later in a game. I think it's fine if they occur early on to say, right, this is the warning now. Any more of that and yellow card's happening. But when it's a cynical sort of attack-stopping challenge or a shirt pull, that's... In certainly in recent times, that's always been a yellow card. There should be no discretion there. It just is a yellow card. And we saw it for both teams. We saw players commit those fouls and yellow cards weren't given. Bardi, did that in some way sort of hamper our ability to win the game?
I mean, what you missed there is Laporte may have made that challenge like Zinchenko did at White Hart Lane under True. Mourinho. But what it would definitely have done is Laporte wouldn't have made the challenge, and then the counter-attack builds, and then all of a sudden you've got a 3-on-3, and then that's a really good goal-scoring chance. So I think that's probably more important than him not getting a yellow. Yes, he wouldn't have made that challenge, and if he did, he's off. If he doesn't, we're through on goal. I think referees, especially in finals, they do tend to ref it differently. They allow the occasion to rule their thoughts. But I do think this does happen in big games quite a lot. Casemiro at Real Madrid has made a career out of this. And I think the referee should have been smarter. It was his first ever final. And of course, these refs have got to get experience somewhere. So you give them a minor cup final to do that in. But yeah, I thought all round it was poor, but there's nothing you can do. You can't go to VAR for yellow cards because then we'd never finish. They'd still be playing now. So I think the refereeing needs to be smarter. The refereeing needs to be stronger. But the refereeing in this country, it is pretty pathetic. They're over-reliant on VAR to make their minds up for them. And it's just that's just the way it is. We need better referees.
Any Spurs fan who's especially upset because it's a final and they feel that the final was poorly refed, I don't want to try to take that away from them, but for me, this isn't specific to this game or to this referee. I don't think that he specifically has done a poor job. I think that he has largely played it within how it is played within our game. This is something that we don't just see in this particular game, but we see week in, week out with City, and we saw plenty with us under Pochettino as well. We got away with quite a few could have been yellows, tactical fouls. I think that this is the way that tactical fouls are refereed in the sport across the elite leagues. And so our frustration, yes, it can be at that one ref if you want it to be, and that works for you. But I think that the if we're looking for a solution here, it's something more systemic towards how tactical fouls are refereed. And I think I'm in support of much harsher refereeing tactical fouls. We saw Fabinho's shoulder barge challenge on St. Maximin, which was yellow. But maybe that should be a red because there's no intent to play the ball, and maybe that's how we should be looking at things. But I don't blame the specific ref because I think that he's refereeing pretty much in line with his colleagues.
Fair enough. I mean, I sort of see what you're both saying. Yeah, it's annoying. I mean, it's not like we were perfect. Lo Celso is an absolute pest for stopping free kicks being taken quickly, for example. He literally does it every time the opposition gets a free kick. He is stood over the ball immediately. That should be a yellow card. He kicks the ball away. That should be a yellow card. So it works both ways. It just irritates me because it's stuff that's it's black and white, it's clear cut, it's easy to crack down on. It's something that referees shouldn't, they shouldn't feel like they're not going to be backed on, because I think most fans will back them on these things. Like, it's clearly a yellow card, just fine, hand out the yellow, get on with it. Yeah, that's the frustration for me, I think. It's because it's easy, and not doing it is frustrating.
We didn't lose this final because of the referee not booking Laporte. There was plenty of other stuff to go against us.
Yeah.
So... We lost it through for many different things, but I think ultimately, you know, I admire how we try to play out the back. I mean, it's always difficult when you're when one of your passing out the back options is Eric Dier, who then wanders into no man's land and gives the ball away. But I think I don't want to go in on Dier. I've been in on Dier many times, and I thought he played pretty well, and he'd put in that kind of performance, which makes me think that if he was a Burnley, he would be fantastic, because he's, if you let allow him to drop deep and defend his goal line, he's pretty good. But I do have to question the logic of being brave in possession when you've got Eric Dier trying to pass into Harry Winks in midfield. That's what's confusing for me.
I thought Dier also played well against Southampton, by the way, in a higher line. I thought he had a very effective match. Mm. I just think Dier's not a bad player. He's just not a great player. Alderweireld's block, which was absolutely insane, barely got a mention in the commentary. I found that completely bizarre. It was like massively overlooked. There was one replay of it. It was such a good block. It was really, really impressive. And I thought he had a really good game too. Yep. I mean, Alderweireld's convincing me now that we did the right thing in signing him to a new contract. He's clearly our best centre-back still. And I hope he remains in the first team next season. I feel like that's all we need to say on the final. Like, it's disappointing, but it's not the end of the world. Expectations were low. They were a little bit higher with Mason, but you know, City are really, really good. They're so good. And yes, they lost against Chelsea previous week. Yes, they lost against Leeds, but that's going to happen with teams every now and again. It doesn't mean they're not a good team. And when they've got Foden and De Bruyne playing at that level, it's really difficult to stop them.
I mean, if you look at... So we always use the Champions League final as a cut-off point of where we were and where we are now. And if you do compare the two teams, there is no comparison. Manchester City are just... obviously, they've got the money and everything, but they're a smarter, well-run business from the top to the bottom. They've got the money to employ the players that they need and employ the manager that they need and everything else. So it is, you know, I know we could have both been in the European Super League together, but there is a huge gulf between us and them. And that was shown up on the pitch, that they had a Cancelo who was one of the best players on the pitch. They've been able to allow him to bed in for 2 years, whereas our fullback is Aurier. And Reguilón, he did his best, but I think he's another player who, almost like when Fernandes joined United, that he came in and it was at this level immediately just because of the players he's been around. And now, because he's been exposed to such mediocrity, it's almost like his ability has dropped as well. So Reguilón is not the 7.5/8/10 player he once was. He's now just an average left back, which is a point which points towards our bad management, bad coaching, and just the bad players around him. I still think, like you, Windy, that there is a lot of talent in this team, but there's a god awful amount of dead wood that needs a massive axe taken to it.
Yeah, agree with both points there. Let's talk about Harry Kane, because we've been putting it off for a few weeks now. It's something that crops up constantly in amongst our questions on the Discord and in our inbox. People want to know what we think about Harry Kane, whether he's going to stay, whether he's going to go, and if he does go, whether that's a bad thing. Do we hold it against him? Would it in some way help us with a rebuild? So Dan Alvarez specifically like talks about whether it's the right thing to let him go. Have I misread that? Dan Alvarez says, if he really does want to go, do you feel like we owe it to Kane to not make it a terrible drawn out thing? Nathan, do you think Harry Kane leaves this summer?
I think probably not. I think it's up in the air a little bit. But I think that a combination of a sort of a limited buyer's market at the moment, especially without the Super League, and also something else I talked about before, which is that like people talk about players wanting to go as a binary thing, right? Either Kane completely loves the club and wants to stay forever and would never leave for anything and would gladly be relegated with us to the Championship, or Kane is sick of Tottenham, refuses to turn up for training, is demanding, is handed in a trade, right? And the truth, of course, is like in the enormous amount of room between these two extremes, in which, you know, for a second, like, put yourself in the shoes of, you're one of the best players in the world, you play for your boyhood club, you've had really good memories there, you're really proud of what you achieved, but you feel that, like, as a player, you're sort of leaving the club behind as it sort of goes a bit downhill, and you maintain most of the time anyway when you're not injured. You're brilliant, and you are sort of, there's a bit of a merry-go-round of managers, and you liked the last manager, but they got rid of him because he was mean to the other players, right, who were less good than you. And you're sort of, you know, if you're Harry Kane, you're starting to think, well, you know, maybe it would be all right to play for Manchester City. You know, I've given Tottenham a lot, and maybe they'd let me go. But if an offer doesn't come in and it doesn't materialise, then he's probably happy to stay at Tottenham. You know, I don't think the discussion around it can be Harry Kane wants to stay or Harry Kane wants to go. It's a huge, huge deal. Think about in your lives, right? You moving from one job to another, you moving from one house to another, and the sort of complex process of feelings. Maybe not always. Maybe sometimes it's like, I can't wait to move from this to this, right? But I think a lot of the time, and Bardi, maybe it's similar for you, the idea of moving is a huge, and it's exciting, but it's also potentially a massive hassle in your life. Sure. and everything else, you know. I think that it's a big deal, and I don't think it's he wants to go or he wants to stay. I think he's perhaps a bit more open to going than he was a year ago, and that's complicated, you know. So look, maybe he wants to go and he does, and we have to put ourselves together after the fact. But I think we're very insecure about Harry Kane in every single regard. And I think we have to be a bit more secure about the fact that if Manchester City or PSG are somehow stupid enough to spend 150 million on Kane when they can instead buy Haaland or Mbappe, then maybe it materializes, but it's probably a fairly low probability. And so we have to be a bit more secure about how Harry Kane feels about Tottenham. So I'm not shaking in my boots at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that basically sums up how I feel too. So you said that maybe he wants to move now more than he did a year ago. And I think that's not just due to the club situation, but also because he's another year older. He's another year closer to the end of his career. Yeah. And that's normal, and that's fine. Yeah, exactly. We, you know, had we won a trophy, had we won the League Cup yesterday, I don't think it changes what Harry Kane wants to do. But I think had we won the league this year, maybe that would change it.
The idea that Totti never considered leaving Roma, right? The idea that Gerrard never considered leaving Liverpool, or until he did, obviously, you know, but they ended up staying. Okay, Gerrard left at the end, but stayed for the vast majority of his career. I think that you can look at other examples. I'm gonna fail to scrape the barrel all of a sudden, but King, you know, the idea that if King's knees were put together, that he would never have left Tottenham. I don't know, man, but I think that sometimes it just works out like that. There's a combination of insufficient interest and insufficient desire to leave, and I think that's probably what we have with Kane here. And so I'm just appreciating him at least while he's here, you know?
I mean, there's one thing that scares me more than Kane leaving, and it's Kane leaving and then Hitchin getting £200 million to rebuild the squad. What is he going to do? Do you know, what kind of squad was he going to build? I want Kane to stay. Part of me is always like, let's set this on fire and see what happens, see what we can do. But, you know, Kane is a guy that offers you 20 goals and now 15 plus assists a season. Do you have to build your team around Kane as he gets a little bit older? Yeah, but he's probably worth it. You know, I get the feeling that, I mean, I can't believe Nathan mentioned Italian football before I did, but you get the feeling that he could just do a Battistuta where he'll just wait until he gets 31 and then just move for the titles if it hasn't come that way. But I don't think he's going to go anywhere unless if someone comes in with a ridiculous bid. And, you know, as we've already covered, no one out there's got that money to buy him. And you're right, you'd go out and buy Haaland instead of spending 150 million on Kane.
Alexander Nathan said, let's leave Steve alone. So he says, he said, Steve Hitchens has been getting a lot of stick from Spurs fans, including yourselves, since the Amazon clip in which he basically just reiterated what everyone in football says about the January transfer window,
yeah.
That it's shit and a bad time to do business. A consensus seems to have developed that he's not up to the job, largely based on this and the fact that he looks like Humpty Dumpty, and I'd appreciate a quick examination of recent transfer history. Lo Celso and Ndombele, Sessegnon, Bergwijn, Clark, all club signings, some presumably in collaboration with Pochettino, Roden, Reguilon, Huijbjerg, club signings, potentially with Mourinho influence on Pierre and Bale, probably Levy, but forgivable, whoever's idea it was. Jedson, Hart, Vinicius, Doty, Mourinho, Mendes signings. I'm not sure that's quite true, but
either way,
let's take it as read.
There's not one success there. You know, Ndombele, maybe something comes out. Maybe Lo Celso comes out. Sessegnon, maybe, but there is Højbjerg. And Højbjerg, you picked Højbjerg, Windy, and that doesn't make you like head of scouting. There isn't one success there. There's not one player that you could go, oh my god, that was a great signing for Tottenham. There's a lot of potential there, but Ndombele's now 2 years in, Lo Celso's 2 years in, Sessegnon has, you know, lasted one season, Bergwijn, I don't even know what he does, Clark, you know, there's no success there. So on paper they sound interesting and good signings, but they've failed.
I think Alex makes a good point, though, and I wonder whether we will view all those signings quite differently after a year of a better manager. I really think that we've signed okay. Like, I don't, when you look at it like that, there might not be major successes, but there are also not that many major failures. Like, I mean, obviously I would say Joe Hart's a failure because I don't like Joe Hart as a player, but, you know, he's free, whatever. Doherty, absolutely outright failure at this point. Fine. No problem with that. The rest, they're kind of in the middle. Like, they could be fine. They could be good signings. They could be really good signings.
I mean, Ndombele was £60 million and right now he's not a £60 million player. He doesn't give us that £60 million worth of talent. And of course, there are mitigating factors and not every transfer is a success and there's manager problems and everything else there. But, you know, Mourinho got at Chelsea, he got his Williams and stuff like that and he was able to squeeze something out of them. And I just don't think those players have been signed thinking long term. Well, maybe I just don't think those players haven't worked. And I don't think any of them can be considered a success right now.
Fair enough. And look, I'm not saying let's not shit on Hitchin, because I find it funny when we do.
but it's nothing to do with the fact he looks like Humpty Dumpty. I've never even thought that. That didn't even cross my mind. He's just a bald guy. And, you know, there's plenty of clever bald guys out there. We don't go after them because they've got no hair.
I think Alex also makes another very relevant point, which is the mixed approach, in that some of them are sort of like more Hitchin-y, more managerial, yeah. And then some of them are Levy just sort of sticking his finger in and identifying financially what is a good deal but what is not necessarily actually good for building a squad, and also allowing way too much Mendes sway over our last couple of windows. You know, mixed approach and mixed results. And I think that when we do things, you know, properly through the scouting network, maybe with some data involved, we've had some involvement with 21st Club. I don't know if we still do. I'm really happy with the Ndombele signing. I appreciate things haven't worked out brilliantly with him so far, but I think we've seen his brilliance on the pitch, and I think that under good management, that brilliance will mean something for us week in, week out. Lo Celso, I kind of feel similarly about. Sessegnon is a player who I was hugely excited by and starting to have a little bit of doubt over now. We did a video on him and we were pretty happy, but things have gone less well for him on his loan since. Bergwijn, I'm still excited by. Clark, I'm still kind of excited by. So, you know, I do think that there are good signings in there. I think that it's, I don't know, I think it's not been that bad, and I think that other clubs aren't necessarily doing that much better. They just have different budgets to us, you know.
I completely agree with you, Nathan, but I do think that's a lot of money there for very little back. We spent a lot of money on those guys, and perhaps that we could have bought maybe two or three first team players who came in and made it successful, or have had a good impact for that kind of money we put there. We could have signed, I don't know, a Neto or someone like that.
The thing with Kane leaving just always freaks me out, is like, I mean, who do you replace him with? Who do you realistically replace Harry Kane with? And Spurs would probably sign Danny Ings, someone of that ilk, right? I'm not against Danny Ings. I think Danny Ings is a good player, but he's miles off Kane. He's miles off of Kane's ability levels. And suddenly you have to completely transform the way you play because you haven't got a number nine that does everything. And it's really difficult. You know, maybe Odson Edouard comes in and steps up and looks really good. Maybe he comes in and he doesn't step up and he struggles with the Premier League. It would just be really hard to sort of seamlessly go from having a Harry Kane as your number nine to not. It's a scary prospect. Let's hope we hang on to him for at least another year for one reason or another. Let's do managers now. Again, loads of questions have come in about managers over the past couple of weeks. Jonah Shipley asks about Nagelsmann. Cam in New Zealand asks, if not Nagelsmann, surely Nuno Santos a good option? Aaron Jennison asked about Nagelsmann. Gabriel Redus asked about Nagelsmann. And Jacko Lombard asked about Giampiero Gasperini. It sounds as though Bayern want Nagelsmann. And if Bayern want Nagelsmann, they're going to get Nagelsmann.
Yeah,
Nathan, you did a video on Graham Potter this past week. What were your findings?
I'm thinking about how much to say without sort of undermining the video and you know, trying to persuade people to subscribe to the Patreon and everything. Look, I went in with some excitement over Potter. Not excitement isn't the right word, but some sort of like interest in Graham Potter, but also a lot of doubts, right? How excited can you get over a manager who is in, what is he, 16th at the moment? And I had some concerns about how effective the football he was playing is. And having done a big deep dive on it in a like an hour long video, I'm really keen on him. I really think that you should not look at the Premier League table and get on board with Graham Potter. I think he would now Nagelsmann is in the picture, he's definitely like a top three pick for me, I think. Let me say this, right? If Graham Potter has our squads playing the way he has Brighton playing, I think we'll be really good. I think we'll be a really good team, and I think we'll have really good results.
Yeah, I think Potter is, he might be my favourite. He might be my favourite manager option. The thing is, he's not sexy. He's not sexy for a number of reasons. I mean, he looks like he works in HR and sometimes he accidentally uses your mug by mistake. You know, he needs a quiff. He needs a rebrand.
If his name, right, was Graham Pottercino, hang on.
Oh god, yeah, it is partly the name. It's a very sort of typically Middle England name, isn't it? Graham is quite a sort of, no offense to Grahams out there, because there's nothing wrong with the name Graham, but it's a bit sort of middle of the road, isn't it? But he's really talented. He's really good. He's really, really, really good at what he does. He's a tactician, but he's not just a sort of tactician in terms of in-game changes, though. He's really good at that. He's a coach. He's an excellent coach. He improves players. He can turn Dan Burn, a 6'7" centre back, into a genuinely quite effective left wing back. You know, this is the sort of ability he has. He's a very progressive, exciting manager on the pitch. Because he's not that off the pitch, I think there's some snobbery around him. And I do like get the point that what's Harry Kane going to think if their new manager turns up for preseason training and it's Graham Potter? I think that quickly goes after 4 weeks of him in charge. I think very quickly our elite players would be like, okay, I can see what he's trying to do here. I can see I've got something to buy into. And I think that would fade away. Bardi, I'd like you to talk to me about Gasperini, who's doing a quite remarkable job this season. What do you think of him?
I mean, it's not just this season, it's a continuation. He had a slow start to the season and he had to rearrange his team after losing, after Papu Gomez moved on. But he's a guy that's continued to collect odd bits and bobs from around football and do great things with them. He's a guy who's very wedded to his football, his philosophy. But I don't think he'll leave Italy. I think he's quite happy in Italy. I think he'll wait to see what happens. I think he'll probably at some point get the national job. He's never really expressed an interest to come to the UK, which is a shame. But yeah, he's a talented manager, but I just don't think it's for us. I mean, he's got some proper cloggers in his team, but he does make the best out of them. And I think I've probably said this before, that you know how good a manager he is because when the players he sells move on, they just don't look very good. And there's, you know, Italy's it's scattered with players that have gone for great money. Kulusevski at at Juve has come through him as well. I don't think we're going to go Italian. I haven't watched Nathan's video on Potter yet, but every time I've watched Brighton, they do look interesting. They do play well, and they do have a lot of trash in their team, but the opportunities and the chances that they create, I do get that feeling that... I remember on the Fighting Cock Forum many, many, many years ago when we signed Pochettino, there was a guy, a Southampton fan, joined. You probably remember this, Windy. And he says Pochettino would do absolutely amazing things at Tottenham because the way he plays, the way he's got a load of junk playing football, that if you just automatically just raise the bar a couple of bits, a couple of levels on each individual, you'd see results. And I do understand that, but I do have a fear as well that it's such a Twitter thing about you got back the manager, but God, I'm doing it twice now in this podcast, but you do have to back the manager. You do need to give him the tools that he needs. And if we are throwing Joe Hart and Jedson at him, then it doesn't matter who we manage. You could have a natural winner, as a self-proclaimed natural winner, and just throw these players at him and it's going to end up in disaster. So God knows what will happen to a young middle-of-the-road manager who won't have the kind of support from our fan base immediately. So I think it's a big decision for the whole club that needs... If you're going to go with Potter, you've got to give him the players that he needs to play that style. And you need to be able to get rid of the players that can't do it.
Yeah. No, I think Potter fits the club identity. And this is something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, and particularly in light of the ESL and Mourinho, about us sort of getting back to our core values and thinking about our identity as a football club. And look, I understand the point that people want to win trophies, not play nice football to some degree. But I think playing nice, attractive football is absolutely part of our identity. I think it's an important part of it. I also think community work, community engagement is a big part of Tottenham's identity. That came through in a big way in All or Nothing. So certainly, even if it's like a cynical thing, then it's what the club wants us to think is a big part of their identity. And that's something Potter's been engaged with and has encouraged his players to engage with. He's unconventional. He's different. He's not the guy from HR that I mentioned before that everyone thinks he is. He does things in an unusual way.
Salsa classes outside of work.
Right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's got a degree in social sciences, you know? He's not just a proper football man. He's an unusual chap. I think there's some merit in appointing Graham Potter and just giving him a few years and see what happens. But equally, I understand that people want a more glamorous name. Personally, I think we need to make sure we go with someone who fits the identity and ideals of the club more than just appointing a name. I think it's really important for our next appointment. Buddy, anyone else that you sort of give an honourable mention to?
Not really. I don't think Nuno Santo doesn't work. Nuno Santo doesn't work for me.
No.
I heard some rumours Roberto Martinez that really,
oh my
really,
God, no.
really doesn't work for me. Allegri is a name that keeps being popped around, but I don't think that works for me either. Yeah, there's nothing really out there that gets me too excited right now.
Nathan, any other names on your hit list?
So Cam says Nuno Santo has Wolves better playing than some of their parts, true, and done good business. Well, they've done Mendes's business, which, as we well know firsthand now, can sometimes be really good and sometimes be really bad. You're essentially playing a different game to the transfer market in which the fees and the players are completely unrelated, and you get a mystery bag of players, right? But Santos isn't the man for us. I respect the work that he's doing at Wolves, but it's not great to watch. It's not the right kind of football for, like, contending for the league. It's good for Wolves and what Wolves are doing, but it's it's mid block. it's not right for us. I've got a couple more managers to get through in my good manager series. I think Ten Hag will be up next. But yeah, I mean, I guess I better crack on because Nagelsmann's not happening, is it?
Yeah, no, I like Brendan Rodgers. I know a lot of people don't like Brendan Rodgers. I don't think he would leave to join us right now, to be honest.
No, I don't blame it. Rodgers did a really good job at Liverpool. Rodgers is doing a really good job at Leicester. As far as I can tell from a great distance, I think he did probably a perfectly good job at Celtic. He's just like, he's a bit David Brent, and I don't like that. He's Liverpool as well, and it just seems wrong. I'm tired of having the rest of the top sixes reject managers. We need to like go out and do our own manager scouting, and yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't be upset over Rodgers. I do think that he's one of the better managers out there. I just want us to have a bit more imagination than that, you know.
This is kind of where I'm at with Sarri. I would really like him to manage Tottenham, but we can't go back to Chelsea's rejects again. We've done that too many times now, but I think he would be great.
I think I read earlier that he's going to Roma.
There you go. This would be a good signing for them. Really good signing.
I think there are a couple of other good managers that just won't get like the popularity. Daniel Farker, I think, has done a fantastic job with Norwich. I think Thomas Frank at Brentford is a good manager. Again, they'd be seen as unglamorous, I think. Perhaps unfairly.
I think a lot of those managers, as I said, that you can go get them, like Gasperini, you could go and get him, but you then have to build the team around them. You then have to give them the players that they need. And at these clubs, they have a system in place in terms of the players they recruit and the players that they put in. Asking them to come into Tottenham with our mixed match of a squad that can't press but can't sit deep or can't really do anything. It's a difficult ask for a manager. Like, can you imagine, like, Bielsa would be incredible, but can you imagine Bielsa coming into Tottenham? The players would be dead. You know, I don't think Kane makes it through week two of training, of pre-season training. So if you're going to go with these kind of real big philosophy managers, then you have to have the infrastructure behind them. This is kind of why I was so surprised that Mourinho didn't work, because he doesn't have that. He has this kind of ability just to get these players through and winning things, and yeah, no, he couldn't even do that. So I think there needs to be a massive change at the club.
Let's touch on the ESL. I've already mentioned it once, but there's a bit of space now between the proposals and where we are now. So we've got a couple of questions. First, Nathan15 says, I've read a lot of people saying they want Enoch out after the proposal to join the ESL. Rightfully so. If that were to happen, wouldn't someone much worse ethically come in to buy the team with our status now? And Doomster says, being in Australia, I feel a little removed from the whole ESL thing. Don't get me wrong. As soon as news broke Monday morning, I knew it was massive, and I'm pleased it's dead in the water. But seeing the fans backlash to this, and it only lasting 48 hours, it got me thinking, what else could or should fans get behind changing football? I wonder if this unified voice could be the start of other changes in football and be used as a force for good. Nathan, how are you feeling now, a week on, with the proposals for now dead?
Relieved that they have died, and that's the way things worked out. I don't know, I because of my my pre-existing political position and the sort of lens that provides me, I don't really feel any different about Enoch now than I did before, because nothing about this really surprises me. This is always what billionaires, and in Levy's case, those acting at the behest of billionaires, will do, is to suck any profit they possibly can at any other cost. This is always how they'll behave. This is how they will try with the Super League again in a few years, in when they re-leverage the necessary powers to do so. And this is always what it will be like. This is always now that football now, like it hasn't been the case for a long time, as Martin spoke to before. Football is part of capital, and capital will always behave in this way. So I don't feel any differently about Daniel Levy or Joe Lewis than I did before. I haven't changed my mind. And as Nathan15 is right to point out, like, you want Levy to sell, you want Joe Lewis to sell. Who do you want them to sell to, and why do you feel better about them? Yeah, exactly. And I completely agree with that. I don't think that I think that Enoch and Levy are probably, you know, the better of a very, very bad bunch. So this is why Doomsday's question is sort of slightly more helpful in that. And I tweeted this, I'm not so much Levy out as I am fans in, and that is the only solution. Fan ownership, what the trust are pushing for, which is fan representation on the board, taking back the club is the only solution to our frustrations, the only solution to our problems. And how do we go about that? Well, we have to keep pushing through that. We have to join up as members of the trust. You have to get your voice heard that way, but we have to lobby the government You know, we have to, because we're not going to, you know, have a whip around and, and buy some shares, right? It's not going to happen. It'll have to come through legislative matters. It has to come through reform. So we, as fans, we have to create voices, yes, within the Spurs fan base and say, hey, Enoch, we want a fan on the board. We want a member-elected representative or more than one in the boardroom every single meeting to be part of, you know, to represent us. And we also have to, as football fans nationwide and perhaps even worldwide, come together as a single voice and say we want our football clubs back and we will vote in national elections in support of that ownership and that belonging. That is the only way that we get what we want. And then, yeah, we can talk about whether Levy is the capital share or whether he's still interested in that, because there will be a loss of interest from business now that they have to deal with, you know, us bloody rabble getting all involved and ruining all their plans. Then we can have a discussion about who's on the other side of the table. But the most important thing is getting a seat at it ourselves.
Yeah, it's very hard to disagree with any of that. I think in the heat of the moment, I was absolutely furious, and I still am furious, to be honest, at Daniel Levy and Enoch. Had a really good chat with our friend Ben from Wheeler Dealer Radio, who made this point, exactly this point, to me on Twitter. And yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much on board with it. Like, I absolutely ultimately want Enoch out and Daniel Levy not running the club, because I can't trust him. I just don't trust him anymore. I don't know why I did trust him, to be honest. I feel stupid. I feel foolish. I feel like he had a green screen and now the green screen's not there, you know? I feel like he was... there was a loincloth and he's whipped it away and now I'm just seeing, ugh, full frontal Daniel Levy. It's not something I want, not something I want in my... burnt into my retinas. But it could be worse. And the thing is, like, Arsenal was sort of championing this new takeover that's muted, who is... So the mooted takeover is that the owner of Spotify will buy into Arsenal with the backing of some of their legendary players. The owner of Spotify has failed to pay artists a fair amount of money for their music for a number of years, you know, costing people their livelihoods and probably mental health along the way. It's all ugly. It's all ugly. And one of the things is people say, and look, I get it, people say, what was Daniel Levy meant to do? Well, in Daniel Levy's world, of course he did the right thing. Of course he did. But that world is not a world that I want. It's not the world that I want to envision for the future. I know I'm idealistic. I appreciate I'm idealistic. But we've shown this week that we can make change happen. And that's why I liked Doomster's question as well. Like, what more can football fans do? What more can football as a community do? And certainly tackling racism is, or should be, high up the agenda. We're putting this out a few days before clubs boycott social media for a weekend. It's not enough. It's not enough. And we've gone quiet about racism in football again. We're just as guilty, you know, frankly. We're just as guilty as three white blokes on a podcast. We're just as fucking guilty. We're complicit in some ways. Why is Chris Powell not our fucking first team coach at the moment? Why is Ryan Mason, who has less experience and less reason to be? We need to do more. And we've shown the power of supporters coming together to campaign. Let's try and use that for good. Let's try and force change that we want to see. Football's been slipping down this long, slippery slope for many, many, many years. Greased by Sky.
We've been complicit, you're right. All of us have been. And it has been interesting to see fans fight back against this. I still think there's a lot of kind of I only care about my club being involved in this. I think Arsenal's protest, a lot of that is linked to the fact that they wanted Kroenke out anyway, really.
But
I do think as football fans, there's loads we can do. The ticket pricing, timing of matches. You'll see when we go back to the fans being in the stadium, I wouldn't be surprised if games are still spread across the day to get the maximum value out of TV without actually thinking about the fans that have to travel around and go to the games. I think perhaps this pandemic, with all of us sitting at home and becoming armchair fans, will probably have a knock-on effect. And I think Dungster was quite good there, where he did talk about the fact that being in Australia, he felt a little bit removed from the whole ESL thing. And this is kind of what they're going for. The local fan is a tiny fraction now of the support. The amount of upset people in England that got upset with this, it pales into insignificance compared to the massive global audience that wants to see Tottenham against Bayern Munich every week.
I think they've underestimated how frustrated the likes of Australian fans, etc., are with this. The idea that like everyone who's not like a game going fan just wants like, you know, the biggest fixture in their TV every week at any expense. I think that like, yeah, this is the mistake. One of the bigger mistakes they've made is that they've underestimated the foreign fan and how much the reason that the foreign fans are drawn to the club is to have that kind of same connection that local fans have and buying into the culture and buying into the history of football rather than just being consumers at the end of the screen.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I get that point. I think maybe I'm talking about more of a football fan in general than perhaps not someone who has his like colours nailed to the mast that he's a Tottenham. It could be like these alt Mourinho accounts that will just watch football and be very transient in their support and kind of skip from club to club. I think for them it's perhaps more interesting. But there's so much that we can do as a fan base, and there's a protest lined up for the 15th of May maybe, and it'll be interesting to see how many Tottenham fans go there to protest and whether or not we get more than the 60 people that turned up last time, because the impression I always had on Twitter is there is a big movement of Enoch out, but we haven't really seen that mobilise yet, so I hope it does mobilise. But yeah, but then as Nathan 15 said, then Daniel Levy goes, who comes in? I don't think anyone better is going to come in. We're not going to get Mother Teresa take hold of Tottenham and live and all of a sudden have these values. I don't see that happening. Not when you're going to invest £1 billion into a club.
That's it. And you know, I'm more hopeful having been through this sort of last week of, I guess, trauma, you might say, in one sense, that the positive change can come. I feel like Gary Neville's done a really good job of making sure it's still a big talking point. I think first and foremost, we need to lobby the government. We need the government to buy into the idea that legacy fans need to be respected, and that football as a community sport, as a pyramid, needs to be given some sort of financial stability. Whether this government is the right government to drive that change, I'm not sure. But what a great manifesto pledge it would be for an opposition party. You know, get all the football fans behind you. That's a lot of people. It's possible.
I mean, the Tory party sort of immediately started talking a big game and then immediately stepped back with their actual proposals just to have a bit of a review and think about things, which is nothing at all at the end of the day. But despite it being sort of not in line with their overarching ideology, I do think that they could potentially just see this as an easy win and a huge bit of point scoring with football fans, and if they were to, you know, step out of their comfort zone and do this. So I do think that it's worth trying to push this out of the Tory party and then obviously still not vote for them, but that's a separate thing.
Well, it's a good point, because so it turns out that Boris Johnson had been meeting with Woodward a week ago, and it seems like he was sort of open to the suggestions of the ESL, and then suddenly once he hears that football fans are against it, he changes side. That's what Boris Johnson does. He goes with the popular groundswell. Yeah. So yeah, it's a good point you make, Nathan. Join the trust. Make sure you join the trust. It's really important that you join the trust. And I think be a bit more willing to be vocal and to sort of to ask for better, to demand better. I think we all deserve that.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud E Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds.
Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.